Axis Mundi.
You're listening to an Irreverent podcast. Visit irreverent.fm for more content from our amazing lineup of creators.
Welcome to Straight White American Jesus. My name is Brad Onishi, faculty at the University of San Francisco, and I'm here today with a new guest, someone who I'm so excited to have on Straight White American Jesus, and that is Sarah Stancorp. So, Sarah, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you.
So, you are the author of a new book called Disobedient Women, and this is what we're going to talk about today. It's a unique book. It's one that really talks about some of the scandals I think many people listening will be familiar with, but it does so from the perspective of the women who use the internet to call out the abuse and other things happening in their communities. So we'll get into that in a second. But before we do, let me just say that you're a very accomplished and seasoned reporter. You write for places. Your work has appeared at the Washington Post Magazine, New York Times, Vogue, Marie Claire, Glamour, The Guardian, The Atlantic, CNN Money, Fusion. I mean, I can go on and on and on. There's no way to name all the places your work has been. And you've been nominated for several awards in June 2018, awarded a Society of Professional Journalists Excellence in Journalism Award, Best Community Issue Story Award for Rape Culture Lives Here, and so on and so on. So you've been writing about these things for a long time. Your book, Disobedient Women, just came out, and it really does dig into the women's story, the stories of the women who expose so many of the scandals that I think a lot of us are unfortunately familiar with. We're going to jump into those. Let me stop and first ask about your own experience. This book and this set of stories really kind of touches on your own journey. What was the pathway for you to being the author of this book?
And actually, before I even keep going, I should tell the listeners I have a bowel disorder. This is how I always know Brad is not making me cry. But anyway, I grew up with an alcoholic parents, and like many kids in that situation, I was scared a lot of the time. And for me, my faith and like turning to God was really my way of coping and my way of surviving. So that's one piece. Also, my family life being what it was made me eager to get out of my house. So I went to the library a lot, and I was a curious kid. And once they let me into the adult part of the library, the religion stacks were like where I lived. And for a long time, it was perfectly okay to be like a good Presbyterian or Methodist kid and reading about Hinduism. Like, I just wanted to know that everyone believed in what they thought. I was super curious. So that's part of it. Up through high school, I had been a very mainstream, kind of middle-of-the-road Christian kid. And then I just sort of fell in with some evangelical kids. And I don't know if I can call it peer pressure, but it became very, very important for me to get saved. And I didn't know what that meant. I was thinking that you don't do that. I mean, don't talk like that. So it was like, I didn't know the magic words, or if I said them, it didn't feel any different. I understood that there were rules, and I hadn't been taught the rules. And the more I spent time in those settings, like Bible studies and different Eastern ends, I got fixated on like these rules that I had to follow. And once I cared so much about these rules, it changed my faith in a way that it wasn't flexible anymore. So I wouldn't say I personally was an evangelical, but my faith was like a lot of people in this country. Besides what I had, and besides what it was enough to change things kind of forever for me.
That's such a poignant way to describe it, you know, a sideswipe. Here you are a Christian person. Here you are a Christian person in a way that your faith makes you feel like safe and like it's a refuge. And yet the kind of influence of evangelicalism on your life really, as you say, is in some ways an image of how it works across the country. You know, you, whether you like it or not, you come into contact with evangelicals who are going to tell you that, oh, you're doing Christianity wrong, or you're not doing it right, or you're going to end up in hell if you're not saying the prayer and that kind of thing. Was it hard to dig into the material this deeply after your own experiences? I mean, both with your home life and your father, and with this kind of sideswiping of your religion?
Yeah. So the plan originally had been to talk about my own faith journey as this, like, not even a B-roll, like a D-roll of stories throughout the book. And part of that was I wanted people outside of evangelicalism to feel like they had a home in the book too. So I was planning on using my own situation as narrative device. And then it was like weeks, within a week, learning I was getting the book deal and signing the contract. My father got very sick, and it became clear my mother was not well. And I became responsible for both of them. And then my father was dying. And I was responsible for this parent that I loved, who I also had these like very complicated emotions about. And I think, you know, it changed how I looked at abuse in a philosophical way, which was helpful. I definitely did not say I didn't include that part of my life in the book, but it was happening while I was writing the book, so there I was. And the more I was considering kind of like what I had experienced, it struck me that, you know, I had this very scary childhood, but a lot of the people I've been interviewing for years, they had that too. Or they had domestic violence and sexual assault. They had all these things. And they also had an additional layer that I didn't. And that was an understanding that what happened to them could be justified, that it was sanctioned by God. And they had this spiritual pain that was different than what I had. Like, I had it, I loved it, I lost it. They either stayed in it or had to flee that spiritual space because the thing that hurts the most became so aligned with God's will. And that hurts in a way that I'm not sure how many other things can hurt that way.
I think one of the things people will find in the book is that you are an author who went about this project with deep empathy and a commitment to listening. And I think, you know, just sharing the little bit of your story you have here, listeners will really get an understanding of why you yourself had a complicated relationship, and one that was, you know, full of pain, but also with someone you loved. And I think so many of the people in the book, if not all of them, had a similar experience, perhaps with parents, perhaps with loved ones, but also with the church and also with the faith that they had grown up in. I mean, it's easy to think of having a bad experience and wanting to just get out, but so many people in the church look at the church as a place of love and refuge, and yet when it's a place of pain and abuse, it's complicated. So let's jump into some of that. You know, you talk about an organization or a denomination we've been hearing a lot about over the last month, and that's the Southern Baptist Convention. You really give us this deep dive into Christa Brown and the ways that the SBC sex abuse scandals were revealed and reported on and ultimately came to light and shook the very heart of the denomination. Can you just give us a little window into that story? I mean, obviously there's a much longer treatment in the book, but what is a kind of entry point into what happened at the SBC? Something I think a lot of folks are interested in.
Yeah. So for me, and I hope this is applicable to other people, it helps sometimes to understand these big big institutions through like one person.
Yeah.
So one person that I think is emblematic of a lot of the struggle to deal with abuse within the Southern Baptist Convention is Krista Brown. She is an attorney who she's been kind of fighting this fight online longer than almost anyone, if not anymore. She describes being assaulted by her youth pastor between 1968 and 1969. And at that time, it was framed as an affair. Now, her stories are really wrenching. And as it was happening, she was told, this is what God wants. If you question me, you're questioning God. Like, in addition to all of just the inner conflict she had, she didn't want any of this to be true. But as she aged through life, she coded it as an affair, trying to move on. She was 16 when all of this happened with her adult married youth leader. And it took until her own daughter was 16 for her to really pause and say, if this happened to my daughter, I wouldn't call it an affair. And that's very common for a lot of sexual abuse survivors. It takes well into middle age to really grasp what was happening and call it what it was. So at all regimes, what is a protracted legal case, but she did file the civil suit and settlement. Her church gave her a written apology, but she also received this nugget of information that shaped a lot of what came after it. And that was that the Baptist General Convention of Texas kept the list. They had a list of who they probably accused abusive pastors were. She just wanted that to be made public. If they're going to abuse care, they might abuse someone else. The church, at least the next church, should know. The next family should know. And she started pressing SBC in 2007 to make a list and make it public. Meanwhile, online, out of act of desperation and a little bit of faith that if I can show them, they'll see this is bad. She started a blog called Stop Baptist Predators and created her own database from publicly available sources. And over years, she got a list of 170 pastors who have been federally accused or convicted. Meanwhile, she is going back to SBC and just getting attacked and ripped apart. And I mean, you've seen this. It happened literally every day in social media. Anytime someone tries to tell a hard truth or even just a personal reality of abuse within the church context, the pile on is immediate and is swift. So that's what she lived through for years. And SBC didn't really take it too seriously until 2019, when the Houston Chronicle came out with its abusive faith series.
So there's a couple things that really jump out to me about Krista Brown's story. One is this happens in the 1960s. I mean, we're talking over half a decade ago or half a century ago now. And here Krista Brown has had the persistence to just, you know, as you say, once her daughter became 16, to really stay on this issue and not let it go. And it really shows the amount of work and labor and like absolute persistence it takes to like do this for half a century, you know, and to keep going. I interviewed Robert Downen about the Houston Chronicle story. Friends, if you're listening and you want to know about what happened with the in-depth reporting from out of Texas on this issue, like look up my interview with Robert Downen. I also interviewed Jonathan Crone, who was at the SBC when a lot of this came to light. And, you know, you're just sort of reminding everyone of the fact that the Southern Baptist Convention had a list of known predators and they wouldn't release it. And they didn't, and you correct me if I'm wrong, they didn't do anything to get rid of those people out of the churches.
Yeah.
Right?
So after the expose, But there started to be increased like pressure from SBC messengers to do something. So there was more channel orders for third-party investigation that came out in 2022. And that's where it was revealed that all this time, Crystal was like demanding. Corners of other people who had been victimized within the Seven Actions Church had been saying, like, make a list, make it public. There was a list. So, like, one of the attorneys, the former general counsel for SBC, who had nasty things to say about Krista, his own staff had been keeping a list, starting the same year she approached SBC. And that was Acts the 60s and included Brown's case. So there are these moments where years later you realize, yeah, they were being heard by someone in there, but largely ignored and reviled. And that's like part of why the title of this book is Disobedient Women, because having the audacity to say, this is happening, this is wrong, you have to fix this. They were treated as genders of bowels and spawns of Satan. Any mutations, they were being disobedient to the men in a position of authority. And that just on top of everything else they have to deal with. And Krista says the way she was treated by the SBC is worse than the abuse itself.
You don't really know what you can believe because there's so many sources saying so many different things.
It's weakening trust between the media and the audience.
I'm pretty sure that I have shared fake news, but I didn't realize it until someone corrected me.
No one knows what to trust and what not to trust anymore.
Misinformation, a threat to democracy, public health, and maybe even the human species as a whole. Or is it? What does this word really mean? And why has it become such a hot topic? I'm Dr. Susanna Crockford, an anthropologist who studies conspiracy theories and the ways they affect religious, spiritual, and other communities. While there is a lot of talk about misinformation floating around, there are a few trustworthy sources where you can learn what it is and how it works in yoga communities, online message boards, wellness spaces, church congregations, and of course, social media. Come for the wacky ideas about biohacking and election rigging, stay for the research on the effects of these ideas on public health and democracy. Misinformation debuts May 24th, 2024, and episodes will be released weekly. Find it anywhere you get your podcasts, because misinformation matters. See you soon.
Oh. Yeah, I guess for me too, just again, to think about it over the course of Krista's life from 1968, 1969 to the 2020s is that's just something to behold in itself in terms of the fight and the resolve. A lot of folks, if we just switch tracks slightly, a lot of folks are watching a documentary about a certain family that had 19 children called the Duggars. And the Duggars have been part of American life for over a decade now. One of their sons is now infamous for his abuse of his sisters and so on. The Duggars never fully, in my knowledge, and I'm happy for you to correct me, identified as part of the Quiverful movement. But so many of us who watched and paid attention have sort of said, you know, the book of James says it's about works and not faith. And, you know, it seems like everything you do is Quiverful, even if you're not telling us you're part of Quiverful. So where do the Duggars, the Quiverful movement, and that whole nexus of conservative American Christianity fit into disobedient women?
Yeah, so it's, I have these moments in my everyday life where I talk about what I'm studying, and most people have no earthly idea of what I'm talking about. And all of a sudden, and like everywhere you go, people are saying, have you watched Tiny Happy People? I guess I have. I watched it the day it came out. Yes, there's a lot to say here. So on the Quiverful front, that's a word a lot of people who act out Quiverful and he's like producing as many children for the army of God as you possibly can. They don't like that work.
Yeah.
So you can live it and do it. And it's like, well, it's not me. So that's not unusual. Within the book, there's like one woman in particular who I spotlight who read the books that you picked up at your home's conference that encourage you, please have as many children as you can, increase the population of Christians in this country with your womb. And even if you die trying, well, then you're a martyr for God.
Yeah.
So that's an element here. The other part of this is that ideas like this popular up by ministries like Bill Gothard's, and it's kind of that floating head that you see many times in shiny, happy people. So his ministry, Institute and Basic Life Principles, IBLP, was huge within a segment of American Christians. I had no earthly idea who he was growing up, but many conservative Christians followed his, they went to his conferences, they went to his seminar tapes, came to their church. I had more than one source say he was like the evangelical pope. I mean, he had minutia that he cared about. He would have in his books explain how you should wear your hair to be modest, how you should position your face.
What?
I mean, that's like so many details. But twice, you know, it was God's hope. You know, you had a cabbage patch show. Like, there was so much that kind of wrapped his opinions around people. And the diggers were kind of the poster children for his movement. What I think folks outside IBLP circles are now realizing is abuse within these families was not uncommon, but also that uneven power structure that Gothard preached and kind of enforced throughout the ministry also put him in a position where he had the ability to do inappropriate things for us people. And a lot of that is also in this book. If people are unaware of God, or they may not have heard of the umbrella of authority, also called the umbrella of protection. But just so people are aware, it's this idea of an umbrella underneath, an umbrella of smaller umbrella underneath, and way over top, you have God. And underneath that, you have maybe a pastor, then you have the father, then you have the wife underneath, then children way down underneath. And if you behave yourself and you follow all of those areas of authority, you're protected from Satan, which exists outside the umbrella.
Yeah.
So the ability to question either your parent or someone like Gothard, who's basically next and underneath God, is really very small. And if you do question, you're seeing basically satanic attack. And that's just, that left a lot of people extremely vulnerable.
Bill Gothard is someone I think more people are now aware of because of, you know, Shiny Happy People and the documentary and talk about these things. And I've seen a lot of folks on social media saying, I never knew, you know, Bill Gothard, who that was. And if you're listening and you don't know, I mean, I would say you can watch the documentary. You can also think of Gothard as kind of like the James Dobson you've never heard of, with perhaps an even more, well, hard to say, not going to get into the business here of judging who's more insidious. I'm going to just leave that alone and say, at least on par with James Dobson in terms of his insidiousness, if not his influence. Would you give us just 1 minute on how did, you know, you talked about Christa Brown and just a half century of persistence and resolve to expose the SBC. What happened in this case, you know, just in brief, of course, there's way more in the book, but yeah.
So, but essentially, until about 2011, 2012, there was a huge outcry. And people who did have negative experiences thought it maybe just happened to them. But then there was a blog called Restoring Grace that first just been the story of saying, hey, abuse happened in these families. Right. And then someone wrote in saying, oh, it happened at headquarters and it happened with Bill Buffer. And there were enough details of her story that the advocates behind the blog had seen or seen behaviors that were in that story. And then a floodgate of it. And it was fascinating in a very disturbing way how consistent patterns of abuse and the patterns of plunking young girls out of these conferences was to get them to headquarters. And then their stories are just rather consistent from there. Once the blog blew things up, eventually there was a lawsuit against IVLP and against IVLP and Crawford. And at a certain point, the case just fell apart. Gothard and his, I'll say Gothard's supporters were being very persistent in reaching out to the abusive parents of these folks who had come forward. And they got very scared. And for the case to go forward, they needed a couple of people still within statute of limitations. And that started to become complicated, and they just also wanted to move on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so much to say here, just about the pattern of abuse, the luring people to the headquarters, the intimidation campaign. It's all in the book, but yeah, disturbing to say the least. You know, before we close here, one thing we talk a lot about on the show, and I talk a lot about in my own work, is Christian nationalism. One of the things I think you do is try to show us that Christian nationalism is a lot of things, and one of them is patriarchal. It's hurtful to women. It's asymmetrical in its gendered structure. How would you just briefly explain that to someone who doesn't see the connection? Hey, I think Christian nationalism is just God and country, people who love the United States and love Jesus. How is that patriarchal? How could that hurt women?
Yeah, well, it's sort of built into the logic model. So at first, I was trying, I actually drew a Venn diagram to try to understand where all these things overlap, because there was gender, there was race, there was power, there was authority, there was Christian nationalism. And I realized they all share this logic of a power imbalance that diminishes a group of people and places them in a lesser category. Functionally, you have the same people preaching, you know, women should be producing as many Christian babies as possible as part of their familial role. And also to populate the nation with Christians. You have the same folks arguing Christians should homeschool to quote, protect their kids from secular education, but also doing so to raise up a generation of evangelical Christians for an important governmental role. You have the same folks romanticizing slavery and encouraging strategic dominion over communities. You also have seen folks covering up abuse in order to protect the power and influence of ministries and churches. And I think in all of those cases, in patriarchy and in Christian nationalism, to me, the justification behind elevating men or elevating Christians or everyone else, it's kind of a weak position. Like, there's plenty of evidence people live other ways. And that think because of that, when you push back either against Christian patriarchy or Christian nationalism, that's why you get these dramatic, major, angry, threatened responses, because it is a weak power. That doesn't mean it doesn't cause damage, but the weak power that is often defended with violence and fear.
It's one of the things that comes through in the book. And I think that people will probably walk into the book intuitively knowing, but will walk away having a very vivid understanding of, which is when Christa Brown calls out the SBC or really just will not stop calling for the release of the list, et cetera. When there are women talking about abuse and the ILBP, when there are people who are calling out these men who are in power, the reaction is not, oh yeah, we'll think about that or we'll see. I mean, it is a violent,
yes,
like strong, we will destroy you kind of reaction. And, yes, you know, I think that's very clear in the work that you do, because, you know, the book is really based on just such a model of deep listening and insight into the lives of the women who really exposed all of this and their bravery and courage. You know, one thing we haven't talked about, and I'll just, this will be my last question, is, you know, the internet, sometimes it's not great. We, you know, I don't know. It gives us things we don't necessarily need. But is it safe to say that a lot of what has happened in the exposure of the abuse that you're discussing here is because the internet provided a forum for women to tell stories, to join in solidarity, to expose those in power?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the things that's true about abuse is that it isolates a person. So whether it's because it's a fear or the abuser wants you to be alone so you can't tell, a lot of people with these really hard experiences thought they were alone. But then they saw online someone else said, oh my gosh, they almost have the same experience. And then as you start to reach a certain threshold and realize it's not just one or two, it's hundreds of thousands, it's millions of people, you stop thinking it's me. You stop thinking it's the person who did this to me. You start to question the institution. And I think that's been the natural evolution of this movement. And it's frustrating. I think right back to your first saying question, one of my motivations for this book is there's been great reporting, like people like me, Robert Towner, like there's loads of people who've gotten these stories. We wouldn't have known about them without the internet. We wouldn't have known about them without the hashtag. There are these podcasts that show, like Mine is a Bar, Mine is a Ball of Marcus Hill, these show these dramatic arcs. A blogger just will write about that for years. There's no credit given to them. So it's like more free labor from women.
I think that's, honestly, I think that's why, you know, they're, what am I trying to say? There's a lot of folks writing right now about deconstruction and about different aspects of the Christian nationalist American landscape. I think what makes your book unique and essential reading is what you just said. It's like, we usually hear about this way down the line when there's a big expose, and thank God for those. Those are good. Like, but behind those exposés, rewinding decades, were women who would just not give up. Even when no one would listen, even when they felt like they were just alone, when no one cared, when it was hopeless, they were like, I'm not gonna stop. And, you know, this book really goes back to that source rather than sort of, you know, picking up down the road with the story. And I think that's where it's most powerful, because you're really hearing it from their voices, and it's different when it comes from the source itself and the struggle itself, rather than the results or just the look at the SBC and how they voted or something like that. So, yeah. Well, first, thanks for writing this book. Thank you for just the all of the work it took, and thanks for stopping by today. Where can people link up with you and find the book and see all the cool stuff you're doing?
Oh, so this is an answer I should have thought about and advanced stuff. I think just heading to my website, sarahstancourt.com. I have all sorts of links there. Twitter is collapsing. I don't know.
Well, yeah, Twitter, who knows? We don't know yet. It looks like Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk are going to have a MMA match to decide who gets to control the threads. So anyway, all right, friends, as always, find us on Straight White JC. Find me at Bradley Onishi. or an indie show. We do this 3 times a week. So if you're so inclined and can think about it, find us on PayPal or Patreon or Venmo. Our Patreon includes a Discord server and our newsletter. You can find us on Substack and subscribe to our weekly posts there. Other than that, we'll be back later this week with It's in the Code and the weekly roundup. But for now, we'll say thanks for listening. Have a good day.
This has been an Irreverent Media podcast.